This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, this is the Fiction Nonfiction Podcast from Literary Hub, where we believe that every issue in your Twitter feed or on the evening news has already been tackled somewhere in literature. I'm Whitney Terrell, the author of the novel The Good Lieutenant.
And I'm Vivi Ganeshanathan, also known as Sugi, author of the forthcoming novel Brotherless Night.
We recorded the main part of this podcast on Sunday, September 25th. It's a podcast about Florida and about a series of linked stories that are set in Florida and that has characters who are dealing with the after effects of Hurricane Andrew and writing that thinks a lot about immigration, real estate, and Miami's multi-ethnic diversity.
But we're recording this opening on Wednesday night, September 28th, and by now it seems clear that significant parts of Florida are getting hit very, very hard by Hurricane Ian. And so before we start, we want to send our sympathy and concern to the people in Florida who are trying to ride out this disaster.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, we're worried about and watching the same video that I'm sure everyone else is watching about that storm that's coming, and we have no idea what's going to happen overnight tonight, and that's the most important thing right now. That does not mean that we don't have quibbles with politicians in Florida. Our original news peg for this podcast before the hurricane arrived was Governor Ron DeSantis' decision to fly around 50 immigrants from Venezuela, mostly asylum seekers who were in the country legally, from San Antonio, Texas to Martha's Vineyard. Good way to prepare for a hurricane. And then he got them to go by allegedly promising that they would get expedited work papers.
That's why we originally wanted to do an episode about Florida. And that's why we looked up a fantastic writer from Florida who can talk to us about what it's like to live there as a second-generation immigrant and talk to us about their writing on this exact subject. And so this episode is a case of serendipity.
No podcast obviously can ameliorate the devastation of a hurricane, but talking to a writer whose new book is both a critique and celebration of Florida, and specifically Miami, seems like the best thing that we can be doing today.
And for that, we're pleased to welcome Jonathan Escoffery to the show. Jonathan is the author of the linked story collection, If I Survive You, a New York Times Editor's Choice, a National Book Award nominee, and an Indie National bestseller. In North America, If I Survive You is published by MCD at FSG and McClelland and Stewart. He's the winner of the Paris Review's 2020 Plimpton Prize for Fiction and is the recipient of a 2020 National Endowment for the Arts Literature Fellowship in Prose. His stories have been in the Paris Review, Oprah Daily, Electric Literature, Ziziva, Agni, Pleiades, American Short Fiction, Prairie Schooner, Passages North, and elsewhere. He is also a graduate of the University of Minnesota's Creative Writing MFA program in fiction and attends the University of Southern California's PhD in Creative Writing and Literature program as a Provost Fellow. Welcome to the show, Jonathan.
Thank you. It's a real pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you here. Your book that Sugi was just talking about, If I Survive You, centers on a couple, Topper and Sonia, who immigrate from Kingston, Jamaica to Miami. In the 70s, they have two sons, Trelawney and Delano. Am I saying their names right? Because I've just been reading their names.
Trelawney and Delano.
Okay. Yes. And they are growing up in Miami and Fort Lauderdale. The first story in this link collection focuses on Trelawney's sense that the people around him don't know how to categorize him. I wonder if you could, just to start off this discussion, if you could read to us from that piece.
Sure. And just to set up Influx and the part that I'll be reading from. Influx begins with 9-year-old Trelawney, the American-born son in this Jamaican family. and he's being asked the question, "What are you?" And when he repeats this question to his mother, she provides a murky rundown of Trelawney's great-grandparents without ever mentioning how he's supposed to identify racially or otherwise. And she suggests that Trelawney tell people, quote, "You're a little of this and a little of that," which might be sufficient in a more ideal world, but it is an insufficient answer in reality. And Trelawney's continually accosted by versions of this question: what are you, where are you from? And he starts to internalize this in a sense, and he chases an answer throughout high school and throughout college. And this is where I'll pick up from in the actual text. "A couple of months before you graduate, before you load up your Dodge Raider and drive the 1,811 miles back to Miami to figure things out, you decide to take a DNA test. You spit into a tube, mail it, and await the findings. 6 weeks later, an email notifies you that your results are ready. You log into your account, and a box pops up stating that you are 38% West African. This is your highest percentage from any single region, as large and varied as this region may be. This feels right, or at least it doesn't strike you as particularly wrong, given your Jamaican parentage and the history behind the populating of the island. But when you click to pull up your complete ancestral breakdown, the top of the page shows 59.9% European ancestry, British mostly, with the smaller, broken-down percentages spanning the continent. The bottom of the page shows 1% Middle Eastern ancestry. The remainder is inconclusive." "Holy shit," Katie says from beside you on the couch. She backs away so she can take you in anew. "I'm dating a white boy." "You, Negro, are mostly European." "You're still black," Katie says, turning serious. "This is the first concrete data you've been provided about your race, though it's actually closer to your ancestral ethnic makeup. Race, you know, is a social construct. It can't be measured because it doesn't exist, biologically. If the results had shown 99% European and 1% African, as long as your skin held some degree of brown and your hair still coiled, you'd still be black, and only black, by American standards. You think of the times you're asked to check a box on the census or an intake form at a doctor's office or a teaching evaluation at the end of the semester. It's one of the few times when you're asked to self-identify by an entity incapable of correcting or denying you, at least in that moment. You may now scrawl a little of this and a little of that beside the other box, but this new information doesn't mean you should check black and white. First, the entire project of whiteness means to the exclusion of and. Second, you are not the progeny of a black person and a white person. You are the offspring of two others. You're brown, but not that kind, and not that kind, and not that kind. Black means expansive enough, inclusive enough, to contain the whole of your European ancestry, to bear the whole of the continent. You're French, you're Italian, you're Irish, you're English, and black, you're black, you're black, then why do they keep asking? You'd hoped that receiving scientific evidence would make easier the process of claiming one thing or embracing being multitudinous, would empower you to say, regardless of what you see me as, I'm this. To say, I'm this, regardless of what city or country or company I'm in. But nothing's changed. Not even the testing of your DNA can help you answer, in one irrefutable word, what are you?
So people aren't really going for the Walt Whitman, I contain multitudes answer to this question that this character keeps getting asked. Can you talk a little bit in general about the process of quote-unquote finding a category in American life or maybe in human life in general? when Ron DeSantis, who we were talking about at the top of the show, flies Venezuelan asylum seekers to Martha's Vineyard, he's engaging in a classic and time-tested way that white politicians have always demagogued race. Those are the others who don't belong. And yet, as the story makes clear, white Americans aren't the only ones who are buying into this need to categorize who is us and who is them.
Yeah, well, one way that I think of this phenomenon of this need to categorize people is that as complex as human beings might be, people really want simple methods of sifting information. And if they can apply their preconceived notions to whole groups of people, often by placing these populations on either side of a binary, so good or bad, American or foreigner, us or them, they won't have to actually do the work of approaching individuals as human beings full of limitless potential. And that potential might include the potential to add value to your life, or that potential could be to let you down in one way or another. And for a character like Trelawney, he upsets people in part because his multiracial heritage, along with his second generation immigrant background, is harder for people to categorize. And unfortunately for Trelawney, he begins to internalize this need to find a neat category for himself because he feels forced to see himself through the eyes of others.
So the book, in many of its choices and in its structure as a collection, it refuses to categorize these characters even as characters seek categories for each other. But, you know, for instance, the father, Topper, acts at times in a dismissive manner to Trelawney, calls him defective. He does some clearly problematic things in his marriage. And in some collections, he would be completely vilified. And he gets a fair amount of that here. But he also gets a story from his point of view, which is told as sympathetically as possible. And this is a story that I think maybe some of our listeners have already read because it was the one that also won the Plimpton Prize. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about Under the Aki Tree.
Yeah, so with that story, I wanted to explore the divide that sometimes occurs between the generation who makes the difficult decision to up and move their family from, you know, everything they know in their country of birth and emigrate to a place like the U.S. And at times, especially, I wanted to explore the other generation, the following subsequent generation that might be born in the U.S. And for a lot of us black children of immigrants, we might feel somewhat excluded from that full citizenship or that, you know, ability to count ourselves as the ideal American children. And so for some of us, there's this, what occurs is there's this phenomenon of idealizing a kind of homeland that maybe never actually existed. And so I wanted to have that conversation between Topper, the, you know, at least one half of the decision-making party who decided to leave Jamaica and who winds up in Miami in particular, and Miami-born Trelawney, who believes that, at least for a time, that his parents have made a massive mistake in moving the family from Jamaica. And I think what I came to realize is that would be a very painful thing for Topper to hear, that, you know, even though he's been able to rebuild his life in America and he's been able to rebuild or build, I should say, a business, but rebuild in a sense his middle class status that he held at one point in Jamaica, and rebuild that in the U.S. And to have his son say that, you know, all of this really was a bad decision.
You gave up all this stuff and did all this hard work. I wish you hadn't.
Right. I wish you hadn't, and things would have been better had you not done any of that stuff. And, you know, that's, of course, that's a difficult thing for Topper to hear. And, you know, he responds in a way that he shouldn't, by my estimation. He calls Trelawney defective, and he says he never would have made it in Jamaica had they actually stayed there. And, you know, Trelawney responds rather violently, and their already kind of fraught father-son relationship takes an even further downward spiral, and we see Trelawney having to live through the consequences of that action as he lives out of his car and has to take some, well, at least chooses to take some really odd jobs.
I thought, Sugi, about Lance Methichang's book, The Brothers Chow. I was thinking, like, it seems to me like in Jonathan, in your book and in that book, and maybe in some other books, there's starting to become a literature of this dialogue between first and second generation families, right? And the intergenerational interplay of the way that immigration has affected them and the way that they think about that. I wonder if you are noticing that as a phenomenon that's just sort of emerging in our literature.
In a sense, I'm trying to think of specific examples of this. I don't know. Like, I grew up, I shouldn't say I grew up, but I in college, I remember reading, oftentimes it was Latina authors who were kind of talking about this experience, especially with Cuban Americans who were looking back at the movement from Cuba to a place like Miami, and often the next generation is trying to sort out exactly what this all meant and how they are to kind of exist in their Americanness. And for me, I wanted to, as someone who's, you know, lived that second generation immigrant experience with my Jamaican parents, it's just something that I'm very interested in exploring, and I wanted to do that for this family of Jamaicans, in a sense. And I mean, I think in particular with a place like Miami, I don't know if immigration and, you know, obviously I'm using the word immigration, sometimes it's asylum seekers, it's people who identify as refugees, but because it's such a multicultural city, oftentimes with it's made up of these Caribbean and the following generation, these Caribbean immigrants and their children, I think there's less of an attitude that one needs to very quickly assimilate into some kind of mainstream American identity. And at times it seems like you're actually rewarded for being able to carry on the traditions of the family. And I think we, you know, in some places we might say, I'll have this conversation with people and they're saying, don't worry, like, you're American. And I think what they mean to say is, like, yes, you belong here, but when you grow up in Miami, American is not necessarily the better thing to be. So people, you know what I mean? So, like, the assumption is not, like, you don't have to rush my Americanness. Like, we are very happy to hang on to our Jamaicanness or our Cubanness or whatever it is. And that seemed to be the attitude of a lot of my friends, I'll put it that way. And so I think for a lot of us, because we hang on to those, you know, that aspect of our identities, I think there's also this kind of, there's this realization that the immigrant story doesn't just move in the one direction of, you know, coming to the U.S. There's also, oftentimes for the following generation, this kind of longing for full acceptance in that kind of other culture. And, you know, in my case, I'm talking about Jamaican. So we have a Trelawney who's imagining, you know, if he's not the ideal all-American boy, because he doesn't have the blonde hair, blue eyes from the commercials. I won't name any name brands, but you know, from the ads, then maybe he can be the ideal Jamaican. And, you know, unfortunately, what he finds is he's not quite able to, I don't know, be embraced as the ideal Jamaican either. And so he remains searching in that way.
Sugi, I just want to say real quick, I think I messed up Sam's book title, so I'm going to just say right here, We called the episode The Brothers Chow because it's a reference to The Brothers Karamazov, but the actual name of the book is The Family Chow. Is that what did I say?
I actually don't remember. I was thinking about the idea.
All right. Well, just in case I said it wrong, we're going to have this part in there to say that I remember that the actual name of the book is The Family Chow. I was also thinking about
Sam's book, but Sam was in particular, I think, interested in writing about people who were the children of, like, the children of immigrants, not the children of immigrants, but I think, like, your book and her book, and we also had Jamil John Kochai on, and these books all have these interesting things in common. One of them, I feel like, is this interrogation of immigration as it exists in relation to masculinity. And I think that, like, rightly, a lot of the time, the conversation around kind of culture bearing, as it's sometimes called, is centered on the pressure that puts on women or femme presenting people. And here, I think we see, like, this really accurate and, like, just really like, viscerally powerful portrayal of the pressure that it puts on men and the pressure it puts on masculinity and intergenerational ties of masculinity to feel like, you know, in what direction am I moving in the right direction? Did I go to the right country? Like, am I presenting with the right kind of masculinity? And am I assimilating to the correct degree? Which I think that seems to me like really interesting terrain. And we had a little bit of conversation with Sam about Asian American masculinity. And I wonder if you can, I'm a little bit stealing a question of Whitney's here, but an important through line in this book is brotherhood. In addition, you know, the brothers are constantly trying to figure each other out through these stories. And we've been talking about categories. And yet siblings are as close as you can get. And I think especially when you're the kids of immigrants, you know, I'm the child of immigrants. And my brother and I speak like a very particular language that is so distinctive and weird that someday I will try to put it on the page. But I haven't done that yet. And I loved reading this version. And yet they couldn't be more different. And I wonder if you can talk about writing these brothers.
Yeah, sorry, I was smiling for a second because I was remembering that my brother and I decided to come up with our own language at some point in our childhood.
And it's like, how many immigrant kids?
Right. And we wrote up a dictionary and we buried it in the backyard somewhere.
That's awesome.
You know, I remember nothing from that, but now I kind of want to go see if I can excavate that. But I was interested in a sense in building these brothers out in contrast to one another. Delano, he has in a sense the confidence. I mean, one might imagine that as brothers with the same parents, they might look enough alike that perhaps Delano would be asked similar questions. What are you? But he has that kind of confidence where, you know, when Trelawney at a time in the book says, well, I'll decide I'm going to answer this question by saying I'm Jamaican, and maybe that will put the question to bed. And what people tend to respond with is like, oh, well, you don't sound Jamaican. And there's also the fact that he wasn't born in Jamaica, and he's the one person in his family who wasn't. And so I think that leaves him a little bit on shaky ground, where Delano actually was born in Jamaica and does have memories of Jamaica and does speak a little bit more with a Jamaican accent. And, you know, I think he moves forward with a kind of confidence that Trelawney doesn't. One of Trelawney's perhaps biggest flaws is that he's just so observant, and he's so interested in kind of cataloging all of the issues that he has to face, but it's not that he doesn't take action, but it's almost like he has to articulate all of the problems before he can take action. Whereas I saw Delano as this character who's just gonna go. He's again less interested in taking part in those national conversations about race and ethnicity and identity, and he just wants to go out and start his own business. And for a time it succeeds until it doesn't, and you know, bigger forces are at play with the 2008 recession, and his business falls apart. And he I think the way I was looking at it is, for the first time, he has to know what it's like to fail and fail hard. And, you know, a lot of where you're talking about the question of masculinity, I think Topper, as the father, he's someone who saw himself as an artist until his father said, well, you can be an artist who I'm going to put out of my house, or you're going to take part in my construction business. And Topper then, you know, kind of builds up his own business as a contractor in the U.S. And that's the thing that works for him. And so, you know, his son starting his own tree service, it's kind of still in line. It's kind of still holding that, you know, one, that more masculine work, but also thinking of what has actually been able to pay the bills. It's something that he can get behind. And so there's this moment of kind of consideration on Trelawney's part where he asks his father, you know, how is it that you loaned Delano money to start his business and you haven't put any kind of money into my education? And we find that Trelawney is saddled down with student debt for part of the book. And I think it's this thing where Trelawney's the one who actually wants to, even though all of the male figures in the book, they all have these artistic inclinations, they walk away from those desires for a time, I'll say. You know, Delano wants to be a musician, but he's leaning into the tree service, and Delano's able to get his father's support by doing so. I think Trelawney's probably not going to get that much support either way, but he wants to be a writer, and that's just another kind of mark against them in his father's eyes. But from the artistic perspective, you know, Delano as that go character, that's one reason I wanted to write his story told in the present tense, whereas Trelawney's stories are often told once he gets a first person perspective, but he's got a couple of stories in the second person because he's, in a sense, he's trying to understand by telling himself the story of his life, like, how is it you have been able to exist as this person who again is defying categorization, perhaps in a way that is not benefiting you at all, but at other times, you know, as a lighter skinned black person, he also has to contend with having that privilege in a sense. But you know, building these characters out against one another, I think was it helped me define them and think about, you know, these smaller ways that people can move through the world and still have their privilege. And be so thinking of, you know, in the final story, Trelawney calls Delano entitled. And I think a lot of people would say, what do you mean by entitled? He's this down and out character in a sense. He's an immigrant. He's black in America. He doesn't have money. You know, how is he entitled? But he's the one who inherited his father's blue eyes. And he's the one who's been shown more family love. And he feels he's entitled to the family home as the firstborn. And things seem to be going that way. And so from Trelawney's perspective, his brother is entitled. And I wanted to pick out these little nuances because sometimes when I say the outside looking in, I mean for people who maybe haven't been marginalized and minoritized, you might just think of these like very flat immigrant black characters, but for me, you know, they're fully formed humans in my head, and you know, they've got their flaws and they've got their nuances, and I wanted to bring all of that to the page.
Okay, we're going to take a short break here and we'll be right back.
And I think, you know, you're talking a little bit about money, and that's one of the things that I think like the story does well, like show the shifting economic situations. You mentioned earlier, I mean, you talked about the tree service, student debt. And then you mentioned earlier, there's a moment where Trelawney is living out of his car. And we did a show with Emmy Nittfeld about housing insecurity. And there are two stories in the collection that touch on that. There's Odd Jobs and Independent Living. And you write about Topper and Sonia's house being destroyed by Hurricane Andrew. And I wonder, like, there's this sort of, yeah, displacement is a theme, and which seems also a particularly Florida thing.
Yeah, it's big in the Floridian context. I'm living in California these days, so it's very big in the Californian context as well. You know, in Odd Jobs, we see Trelawney picking up this this kind of gig because he's kind of living out of his car and he's starving and he's unemployed. In independent living, though, he's got a full-time job and he still can't quite afford to, you know, get an apartment and pay rent. And when I was living down in Long Beach, I would walk from the metro station to my apartment, and I would pass all these people who seemed to be, you know, going out and getting ready for work. It seemed apparent that they were all employed, but I'm talking about dozens of people living out of their vehicles. And I think, you know, in major cities, it seems to be moving that way. Getting back to your question about, you know, Florida, and in particular South Florida, in the last, I'll say 3 years, rents have been, you know, not just doubling but tripling on people, and it isn't a state that is probably, you know, in the foreseeable future, the way things have gone, it's not a place where there are any protections for renters. And so there aren't any caps on how much you can raise the rent, and people continue to be pushed out of, you know, different neighborhoods, certainly, but out of Miami in general. I talk to people a lot who, they now live north of the city. They live in Broward County and in cheaper cities, that are also getting too expensive as well. And so, you know, I think it's a huge issue in South Florida in particular. But then there's also, you know, the sense of impermanence that climate change and climate disaster is also bringing on. You know, if you buy in Miami, you certainly should be aware that there are, you know, there's the threat of rising tides. And you know, in the book, I do talk about that, particularly in the final story, that they have these lunar tides where, you know, the city could be in drought, but the tides come up and they flood much of Miami Beach. They flood much of downtown Miami. And what's happening is that now in places like Little Haiti, which used to be, you know, it's historically Haitian area that people from outside of those groups would not necessarily be interested in moving into those areas. Now they've discovered that that is where the highest elevation in Miami is. And so now this is where gentrification has moved. It set its eyes on that, right? Because now the wealthy want to kind of take over that historically Black, historically Haitian area and start building condos for the wealthy so that they can be, I guess, the last to go when the city finally is sunk.
And we should say that Tropical Storm Ian is heading toward Florida right now. It's supposed to be a Category 4 hurricane. So by the time this episode drops, we'll know a lot more about that. We're recording on a Sunday. Today's the 25th, I believe. So here come the politics. 20 years ago, John Judis and Rui Teixeira published a book called The Emerging Democratic Majority. Its arguments are complicated and nuanced, and we're going to link to a good piece about that book by New York Times' Nate Cohn in our show notes that came out recently. But at least part of what they were saying was that demographic change and the increasing diversity of America should help Democrats at the ballot box. Florida seems to be a prime example of this kind of change. I mean, the multi-ethnic diversity is place, and particularly Miami, is on display in your book. But why can't Democrats win in Florida? If you know, why are Marco Rubio and Rick Scott the state senators? Why is DeSantis the governor? Why did Trump win this state?
Yeah, I mean, one thing that is a bit frustrating is that what you'll find in a place like South Florida, and you know, Miami being the city that I'm more familiar with, is that Democrats can be at times associated with socialism and socialists, and for, you know, some of the younger generations in Miami, you know, we might think, we might hear socialism, Canada, you know, England, maybe like national healthcare, and we might think of European countries that have support systems for their citizens, and, you know, there may be, you know, free or low cost education depending on where we're looking at. But for a lot of people in South Florida, when you hear socialism, you're thinking of Fidel Castro, and you're thinking of property being seized, and you're thinking of, you know, businesses being seized, and you're thinking of whole lives being kind of ruined by these dictators. And so, you know, for a lot of people in South Florida, I don't think Democrats have been very good at, or maybe I should say Republicans have been very good at casting the Democrats in that kind of light of, you know, people who aren't interested in rewarding hard work, and people who are more interested in seeing the United States turn into one large welfare state. And that all has to do with, you know, messaging. And unfortunately, I just don't think the Democrats really are, it's almost like they do understand the nuances, and yet they fail to communicate that they are not that party who's here to throw you out of your house and you know, take away your business. And you know, on the face value, I think there's a lot more to it than that, but, you know, just from a purely messaging standpoint, they haven't you know, maybe it's a bet that they've made that they just don't think it's worth getting into those weeds. But, you know, when you're in Miami, and that, you know, that is the landscape of a lot of immigrants who've had a lot of bad experiences with anything having to do with you know, social safety nets. You know, it's a kind of triggering phrasing for a lot of people down there.
So according to NBC News, about 55% of Florida's Cuban American vote went to Trump in 2020. And Trump is, as we've talked about repeatedly on the show, no friend to immigrants or to people of color. And we began the podcast talking about how current Florida Governor Ron DeSantis has been demagoguing the subject of immigration by sending Venezuelan asylum seekers to Martha's Vineyard. And those asylum seekers are fleeing a socialist dictatorship, much like earlier Cuban immigrants did. And the Republican Party used to welcome immigrants like that. And now they don't. You know, you're not Cuban, but your book is aware of and comments on the community quite a bit. So can you talk about, and it's not just what do they not see in the Democrats, but what do they see in Trump, DeSantis, and the Republican Party?
Yeah, I mean, I think what a lot of people in the U.S. don't really understand is that Cuban Americans, a lot of people who are grouped into the Latinx category or Latino or Hispanic, is that they may not actually identify with those categories at all. And so where you're saying, you know, I think this is a place where a term like POC, that kind of, or BIPOC, those kind of catch-alls that imagine that we people who might fall under those terms might have similar agendas, don't really understand that a lot of Cuban Americans in Miami in particular see themselves as white, and they, you know, they have not much of a vested interest in associating with you know, people of color in a sense. If you understand how they existed before they came to the U.S. or multi-generationally, it would be the same as asking, well, you know, why are so many white people interested in seeing Trump and DeSantis empowered in these ways? And so I think it's a situation where people aren't necessarily understanding the cultural landscape of South Florida, where, you know, a lot of Cuban Americans in Miami, they're doing quite well financially, and they have their own businesses and own homes, nice homes, and are interested in voting in the way that might lower their taxes or see that they don't have to pay for universal health care for their employees. And, you know, certainly that's not all Florida Cuban Americans, but especially
I can imagine Topper feeling that way. I mean, he's Jamaican American, right. But I think that he would.
Right.
That's it's possible. I can imagine him voting for Trump. He's your character. You can tell me how he votes, but you know.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't create the Topper that votes for Trump, but I think that is a great point when you think about a lot of people who, so taking it away from people who necessarily,
I mean, he's got his own business. He's interested in protecting that. He doesn't want to pay more taxes, mm-hmm. I would assume, you know, and he wants the freedom to sort of like be independent and not have the government mess with his life at all. That sort of seems like his attitude. That's the part that I would think that he might be attracted in the way that you were talking about other groups being attracted to sort of that kind of part of the Republican message in Florida.
Yeah, I mean, the truth is I know a lot of Jamaican, particularly, you know, the first gen immigrant who, you know, packs it up and moves to the U.S. and who's able to find some success here, absolutely. I think, though, because this is where race often comes into play, where you might find yourself as that, if in fact you are a Black Jamaican immigrant, you might have to weigh your options in terms of, well, it might be, it may suit your pocket to vote one way, but then in terms of these social issues and a party that is, you know, the Republican Party being off the rails with, you know, basically not even denying, you know, the xenophobia and the racism, you know, some people are still going to vote for their pockets. And, you know, I do know some of those Jamaicans, but they keep it a little bit quieter.
You're right. Topper is wise to that part, right. Also. I remember him talking about that stuff.
Well, you know, socially, and again, I think this is why it's important to create these dynamic characters, is that I think for a lot of Black immigrants who come to this country, whether they're Jamaican or, you know, I'll stick to the Jamaicans, there's that political disconnect where you have a Trelawney saying, you know, there's no such thing as a bad neighborhood. If there's any crime, it's because of white collar greed and it's because of systemic racism. And then you have, you know, the older generation who's like, what the hell are you talking about? Like, if someone shoots you, they shoot you, and it doesn't matter where it comes from. And I think there's these different ways of viewing the world, and, you know, there's the kind of theoretical, you know, what's the systemic problem, and then there's that more ground level, how are we going to get through, you know, the day without, you know, getting caught up in what's actually literally going on around us. And so the problem I see, though, is that for some of those, the older generation, is that they may not be taking into consideration what it's going to be like for their children, who, especially with Black immigrants, like they're not going to neatly be able to just assimilate into society without racism continuing to plague them. And so, you know, I think it's a nice sprint to say, well, I'm not going to get caught up in these issues of race. I'm just going to keep my head down and work until I build something. But, you know, unless you're not having Black children, I suppose, if you're going to, you know, breed out the Blackness from the family line, you're going to have to consider these things. And that's some of the conversation. That's the kind of conversation that I'm interested in having on the page and in the fiction, and not necessarily with any you know, belief that I am answering these questions, but I think we need to have these questions because, you know, I don't think it's great to just sit back and say, you know, we can never get over these problems. The systemic problems are so big, we'll always be underneath them. But at the same time, you know, that conversation needs to continue to happen, so that we can figure out what we can actually do to you know, get out from underneath these things.
Well, Jonathan, I think ending with these questions on our minds is a great way to send our listeners to go and get your book. We want to remind everyone to go out and pick up a copy of National Book Award nominated If I Survive You, which is out now. And Jonathan, thank you so much for joining us and sharing all of your thoughts about this.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's it for the Fiction Nonfiction Podcast. This podcast is produced by Anne Kniggendorf. Our theme music is composed by Travis Workman. You can subscribe to us by typing fiction/non/fiction into the search bar of your favorite podcast app. Please go give us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts if you haven't done it yet. You can also listen, find previous episodes, and read excerpts from our interviews at the Literary Hub website, lithub.com, where the Fiction Nonfiction Podcast page is listed under the Lit Hub Radio tab. We'll also post that show page with links to the books we referenced this week on Facebook at FNF Pod, on Twitter at FNF Talk, on Instagram at fiction.non.fiction.podcast. You can find video of our interviews at our own Fiction Nonfiction Podcast YouTube channel and IGTV channel and on our website at fnfpodcast.net, where our back episodes are grouped by topic areas. Happy reading!